Hello and good morning. Paul D'Souza and Warren Giroux from Sightline Wealth Management. It's Friday, April 24th. And Warren, good morning. How are you?
Good morning. I'm great, thanks. How about yourself?
Doing well. It's been a very busy week, and I think oil probably topped the headlines. So let's begin with that. The May contract went negative to $37. How does this happen? Let's begin explaining this to our listeners.
Well, the reality is there was just an imbalance of the sell and buy orders. And as a lot of people may or may not be aware, a futures contract comes with it a delivery obligation if you hold it to the end. So in other words, if you were a buyer of oil futures and you held it to the end of the contract, which expired on Tuesday, then you were expected to take delivery. And unfortunately, what happened was the storage facilities and the depots were full, so there was no way to take delivery. So the people who had actually bought the contract, they had to pay someone to take the oil off their hands, and as a result, it went negative. On Tuesday, when the contract expired, by the time it expired Tuesday, it had gone back up to about $1 a barrel or something, but the price had recovered to just about flat. This condition may persist into June and July if we have this imbalance. But typically, these contracts roll out. And for some reason, on the May contract, somebody messed up somewhere and they didn't roll their contracts out. So they got caught.
Yeah, that was
the first time it's ever happened.
The major culprit there was the oil ETF, symbol USO. And I've been skeptical of various types of ETFs. There's some that are very liquid and work well, say for the S&P 500 index, et cetera, and the triple Qs. However, commodity ETFs are a very different story. And the USO has had tracking errors throughout its inception, throughout time. And what happened on this past week was their mandate was to roll over, I believe, 50% of the contracts, I think 1 month out, and then the next 42 weeks out, and then the remaining with, you know, a few days remaining. So they got caught with about 25% of the May contracts remaining due to expire in the next day. And as an ETF, they couldn't take delivery. I mean, some ETFs that take delivery, but they couldn't take delivery of oil. So as you say, they had to get out at any price, and they had to pay someone to actually take it off their hands. And so, yeah, we have the problem of there is no storage. There's just thinking, the cruise line's not operational. What do you think for the business idea of converting that to a whole 2 million barrels of oil? Would that work?
I guess that would be. I guess you could think that might work.
Okay. We're kidding, of course, but it is a problem. And as you say, I think it'll happen in June. And I think the signal, too, is because you're starting to see the industry and producers shutting in their wells. And that's quite alarming because, well, eye-opening, we should say, because that indicates that this is a longer-term problem that they probably foresee until the end of the year.
Well, don't forget, Paul, I mean, the world is producing about 100 million barrels a day, I think. And there's a shortage in demand of about 36 million barrels a day. We saw a couple of weeks ago, OPEC and Russia reach an agreement to reduce some of the supply, but it was only like 9.7, I think, million barrels a day, which is woefully short of what the number needs to be. So as long as we have a global economic shutdown, demand is going to be much, much lower than what is being produced. And we're going to have this supply imbalance, supply-demand imbalance.
So we have President Trump tweeting this week. Let me find it here. He basically said, "We will never let the U.S. oil and gas industry down. I've instructed the Secretary of Energy to formulate a plan which will make funds available so that these very important companies and jobs will be secured long into the future." What has Prime Minister Trudeau said?
I think absolutely nothing.
That's right.
and that's really a shame when you think about it, that we have absolutely no leadership. In this regard, we've even struggled to even have a pipeline. I guess they approved the pipeline, but we'll see when that gets built. We can't even get our oil to the marketplace, and it's really quite sad. So,
well, there was a bit of an aid package. It was $1.7 billion to clean up abandoned oil and gas wells, and this is a more of an environmental political move here, and it'll keep probably a few thousand jobs. And also, I think $750 million for reducing methane emissions. So nothing actually directly to these companies. And other than the large caps who can survive this until the end of the year when price normalizes, the numerous small and mid caps are going to struggle. And I think we'll start to see some major dislocations with those companies in the next month to two minimum.
Well, you would think, given the current situation, that quite a few of these companies will be available for, mergers and acquisitions, because they do have reserves, and some of the larger companies may have an opportunity, just those who are well financed, to pick up some of these assets at very, very low prices. And the other thing is, who's to say that the price is going to return to normal by year end? That's really going to be based, I think, more on the economic activity globally, before, oil gets back to sort of a more normal level. And, it had been weak for quite some time going into this. I mean, it was around the $50 mark, but this level that we're seeing today is unprecedented.
Well, that's a good point. Just reading some surveys here. So a quarter, this is the Canadian Federation of Small Businesses, which is 70% or 75% of the GDP of Canada and the U.S. A quarter or 32% of small businesses in Canada are unsure if they will reopen their doors as a result of the economic blow from COVID-19.
Not surprising. A lot of these businesses are obviously they're smaller businesses and they don't have the financial capital backing them. It's very difficult for them to get loans. They've had to lay off their workers, and in some cases they've had to shut down entirely. And in spite of the aid packages, the unemployment insurance benefits and so forth and so on, it's just not going to be enough. And the other thing is, and we've talked about this in past discussions, the consumer's not going to come back to the market as quickly as a lot of people think, because, if they're not working, they're not paying their mortgages, they're not paying their credit card debt and so forth and so on. It's not being forgiven. They're still going to have to pay it. So when they finally do get back to work, they're going to have a catch-up, and that catch-up may take many, many months. And as a result, they're not going to be out there spending their money. They're not going to be going on vacations, et cetera, et cetera. So
that's right.
The unintended consequences. Yeah. Go ahead.
There was a very simple solution provided by an individual on a YouTube video that's quite going viral, and he is extremely upset. But he comes, says, "Why do I have to think of this? Why do I have to say, why don't you just add the 3 or 4 months that we're not working here, mortgage or rent, to the end of our term or the end of our lease? So for instance, if I have a mortgage with 15 years and 5 months remaining, after this, it will be 15 years and 10 months instead of, to your point, how are they, this $1,200 check plus $500 per child, going to help with anything? He says it may cover, a part of his expenses. So it makes a very valid point. And in addition, it's not only where the consumer won't be spending when they return, they probably aren't even confident in going out. There's another poll I'm looking at. If stay-at-home restrictions were lifted, would you be comfortable going to the following, a bar or a restaurant? Only 29% said that they would be. Getting on an airplane, 15% said they would be comfortable getting on an airplane, and a large event, 13%. So there's that double whammy too of, how long will this recovery take? I think longer than people might probably be thinking.
Well, the other thing to look at too is when they do open, consideration is, what is the business going to look like? For example, if we are going to be keeping our distance, let's say restaurants with a seating capacity of 100, if you remove every other table, their seating capacity drops to, say, 50. So what does that do to their pricing model? Mm-hmm. they may have to, you know, double their prices or more just to break even. And is the consumer going to be willing to pay for that additional expense? The same thing on airplanes. They're talking about removing the middle seat. So all of a sudden, you know, if you only have, you know, four people per row versus six, what does that do to the pricing model there as well? So, yeah, there's a lot of things to be sorted out at this point. We have absolutely no idea, you know, what the new normal is going to look like going forward.
Mm-hmm. And there could be mandatory face masks for everyone.
That too.
Yeah. Okay. And so in terms of earning, or let's talk about the unemployment numbers, or the jobless claims, I should say.
Yeah, the jobless claims came out this week, and it was 4.4 million people applied for jobs again this week. So now we're looking at about 25 million people who have applied for jobless claims in the U.S. And the projection, I guess, I think it was J.P. Morgan had a projection a couple of days ago that they thought by May the unemployment rate in the U.S. would climb to over 16%. There's some estimates in Europe that the jobless claims, which seemed a little bit short to me, going to unemployment rate going to 10% from 7, which is what it is now, apparently. But that seems a little low. So it's having a significant impact on the job market, obviously. And I would expect the jobless claims will be declining only because there's fewer people working. We've already had the majority of the shutdown. So maybe that number decreases, but it's been pretty significant over the last three weeks.
Right. And the PMI index?
The PMI index, in the U.S., we just had those numbers the other day, and the services PMI fell to 27 from 39 in March. The manufacturing PMI dropped to 36.9 from 48.5. And remember, any reading below 50 indicates a worsening conditions. So these numbers are quite poor. And if we look at the PMI in Europe, it's even lower than that. So we have the PMI, depending on which number you're looking at, services or the manufacturing, as low as 13.5%. So that is quite significant. They're thinking that the GDP, based on those numbers, and particularly in Europe, they're looking or expecting the GDP to fall by shrink by over 7.5%. So that would be in a very severe negative territory in Europe for Q1. I haven't seen any numbers projecting, recent, taking into consideration the most recent numbers, what they think GDP is going to be in Q1 in the U.S. yet. But it will, I can't see how it would be positive anyway. It has to be fairly, things have been coming out this past week. Some companies are actually producing some good earnings, but it's been their online businesses like Target, for example. In-store sales were down substantially, but their online sales were up 275%. Some of the pharmaceutical companies are reporting reasonable earnings. But one thing that is common that we've seen this past week, also it started last week with the banks, the guidance. They basically are not providing any guidance whatsoever going forward in the next quarter. So, and I guess that's to be expected since we have absolutely no idea when we are going to start reopening the economy, and then what it's going to look like when we do.
Right. So in terms of earnings, we've seen, as expected, lower than last year. And this is just probably only due to, I think, 2 to 3 weeks of first quarter being impaired. And second quarter, as we've discussed, won't be very good at all. And I'm wondering too, how with most companies now suspending guidance, what's driving the stocks to these levels? And there's an interesting stat in terms of the amount of stimulus that's been provided by the Fed in the last 6 weeks, roughly equals the rise in the value of the stock markets in the United States. So it's been a direct, as we spoke a few weeks ago, that Botox injection of liquidity into the markets, where It's temporarily reduced the wrinkles, the fine lines. It's now wearing off. I'm expecting another round of liquidity, an aid package in the next month or so, just to further prop things up to keep it going along until there's some sort of recovery.
Well, we did see Congress, the House approved a $484 billion bill that replenishes the COVID aid program for small businesses in the states. Again, the indications are that is not going to be enough. This is part of the phase program that Trump announced when he announced the $2.2 trillion, I think it was.
Right.
Initially. So this is, I think this is considered part of phase three or something of that package. So, I think you're right. There's going to have to be more liquidity put into the system, more assistance as this persists. And the shutdown persists, there'll be more assistance to have to be given.
Officially, the Fed is not able to purchase stocks. However, there's been discussions that they actually are doing that. And Janet Yellen came up this week saying that the Fed should purchase stocks. Now, we know that they're in terms of asset purchases of bonds, high-yield bonds, treasuries. This would form a whole new moral hazard now if they're going in specifically buying stocks. I could see probably indexes, but stocks. Yeah.
That's what I was going to say, indexes. I think, the Japanese Central Bank has been buying equities for a while. They've been buying ETFs and indices, and I think the same thing would apply here. It'd be very difficult for them to go out and buy individual stocks. Mm-hmm.
In terms of earnings, we have the top five reporting next week of the S&P 500. That's Microsoft, Amazon, Apple, Facebook, and Google. What's interesting too is their dominance in that index now. It's 20% of the S&P. It's also equal to roughly 325 of the bottom companies of the S&P 500. So as we know in past, when we have a sector or several companies dominate the weighting in indexes, that's usually not a good idea. And there's other stats there too in terms of the Russell growth to value ratio. The relative strength is extremely high right now. It's only happened at this level in 1980, in 2000, and 2007. And what's coincidental with each of those times is that's just prior to a large market decline.
Well, here we have it after a major market decline, which is kind of unusual.
Isn't it?
Yeah. Well, although, we've had this major decline, but we've also had a significant rally off the bottom, which has been pretty interesting to watch.
Well, again, that's the Fed liquidity injections doing that. And then I think, just from history, just noticing is the job of the first bounce is usually to convince everyone that the worst is over. There's a V-shaped recovery, there's optimism, and then there's another drop. So nothing new from what you and I are discussing, just we're cautiously optimistic, but we don't believe that there's legs to this yet.
No, I don't think so. I think there's more to come. The news is, the data points are becoming increasingly negative, as we pointed out. I don't expect to see that change, at least in the near future. Maybe by the third quarter, maybe the fourth quarter, we'll see some improvement, but certainly the second quarter is going to look pretty, pretty soft.
Right. Who's been very quiet is Warren Buffett. And been thinking about this. And so in 2008, during the depths of that crisis, he came out and would he put large investments into GE and was it Goldman Sachs or Wells Fargo? I don't recall now. And, the famous quote, "Buy America, I am." And his partner, Charlie Munger, was interviewed with the Wall Street Journal. And he said, the phone's not ringing off the hook and things are very quiet. And so they're not doing anything now. And, he's often said that most of the time they sit on their hands and then they buy with aggression when bargains are around. So reading into that, I'm just putting it out there that possibly they're waiting for more bargains. And so there's probably lower prices to come. And then that's when Warren will act. He's close to 90 years old, or could be 90. And Charlie Munger's 96, 97 years old. Maybe they have one last large purchase as, you know, as their legacy before they pass on the reins to whoever will be managing Berkshire Hathaway's assets. I've been thinking about this. Yeah.
Well, yeah. I mean, if you look at what he's done in the past, I think there was a little more visibility into the future regarding economic activity turnaround or in a particular industry or whatever. This one, this situation is much different than what we've seen in the past, and it encompasses almost every impacted almost every sector of the market. And given the fact that we don't have any real visibility, and he's one that likes to see where, you know, or have a vision to where things are going, he may be looking at this. I understand he's saving an enormous amount of cash, that he'll wait this one out a little longer before he right. starts jumping back in. That's would be my guess.
Yeah, that's good insight. Munger's quoted as saying, nobody in America has ever seen anything like this. This thing is different. If everybody talks as if they know what's going to happen and nobody knows what's going to happen. So it does sound like they're just waiting on their hands until it's very apparent that they should be buying.
Yeah, I think so.
Okay. Now, let's talk about the second wave. So there's discussions of reopening sections of North America, cities, states, provinces, and that would coincide if by the time everybody gets back with the flu season. And I think, look, everybody wants to get back to normal, but I think this will take longer than what people want it to. And as you're seeing in other cases around the world, the second wave, unless it's largely eliminated and flattened, the curve flattened, then this won't go away quickly.
Well, one of the other things to consider, Paul, I think governments are finally realizing or waking up to the reality that with the economy shut down, their revenues have dried up. And on top of the fact that they're increasing liquidity, they're putting themselves in a very precarious position financially, more so than they were when they entered this crisis. In fact, just the other day, I saw an article from the IMF where they're talking about a forgiveness program for they call it a jubilee for emerging markets. As you know, emerging markets have borrowed an enormous amount of money in U.S. dollars, or I should say bond issues, have issued a large number of bond issues in U.S. dollars. And with their currencies falling off and against the U.S. dollar, their ability to pay it back is going to be, it's going to put extreme pressure on them. And now on top of this, so anyway, the IMF was suggesting some sort of a I don't know how many trillion dollars it was, but a jubilee, they call it, a forgiveness of debt, right. A cancellation yes. of debt in foreign markets. So, you know, I think they realize they have to get people back to work so the revenue flow starts reestablished. And it's a catch-22. The other thing to consider, too, is that a lot of people think that because the vaccine is so far off in the future that immunity – herd immunity is the only way to solve this. Sweden is one of those countries that has not shut down, and we'll have to look at the numbers to see what it looks like. But maybe in one way, it's probably a good thing some of the states are deciding to open up, so we'll have some more data to determine, okay, is the second wave going to be as bad as the first, and are we going to actually develop the herd immunity that we need to survive this in the longer term?
I was reading that President Trump was banning migrant workers from coming in to the United States. And I don't know if that's actually happened or he's actually considering it. And then farmers are probably not planting crops this year. And if they do, there wouldn't be as many people there to harvest it. So there could be interruptions to fruits and vegetables and food supply this summer.
Well, Paul, that's one of the issues that we have to worry about. But the other thing, more maybe closer to home, is we've seen, I think it was 8 major meatpacking plants close their doors recently. So it's not only we have to worry about the supply of vegetables and the ability to get the harvest, you know, on the shelves. it's also meatpacking industry is under extreme stress as well. So, yeah, I mean, this whole food chain, and you and I spoken about this, I know several weeks ago, that if this situation and lockdown persists, that at some point it's going to impact the food chain. I know in certain emerging markets, I was reading just the other day that they're having real issues. I think Thailand is one of those countries. They're having to give away food because people are starving. These are people who are based primarily in the service industry. So we're not far away from that. You know, if you consider how long it takes to refire how long it takes to grow vegetables, how long it takes to grow grains and our crops, it doesn't happen overnight. So, unless we have it stored, we may have a shortfall.
True. All right. So let's move over to what we haven't discussed in our weekly calls is our alternative investments in terms of our private debt funds, mortgage funds, et cetera. And they have performed thus far extremely well. They've preserved capital. I think most of them have positive returns. I think one has -1%, and that's due to some, provisional write downs on the warrants and the equities. And then that will turn around in the months to come. So it's been extraordinarily successful thus far. And I think one of the key factors in that, as well as people are wondering, well, how are these underlying companies not affected by the economy? And that's due to most of them being in essential services.
Yeah, we're finding that we're having weekly calls with those managers, and we're finding that we'll just use an average number of, say, about 85% to the low 90s of their loans are with essential service companies. So they're not being impacted. And in some cases, they're finding the business is actually growing. And with the exception, of course, we have a couple mortgage funds, and they're on the residential side. They're not involved in the malls and commercial real estate. So they have also been able to maintain the revenue flows as well. They haven't been impacted as much as the retail space type REITs. Again, we're checking on them every week. They're talking to their borrowers, making sure that the collateral is safe, making sure that the people on the other end are able to make the payments and so forth and so on. So yeah, it's actually worked out quite well. It's been one of the bright spots in our portfolios is the alternative space, especially the debt space.
Yeah, key point to point out in literally the funds we have in clients' portfolios are senior secured in terms of the capital stack. And they also have, most of them have the personal guarantees from the borrowers as well.
Yeah, that's been a very important aspect of it as well. So they're well collateralized. The loan to value in quite a few of these programs or these lending is way down in the 50s and even lower than that. So we feel that we're quite protected. And as I said, our debt managers are on the phone every week with all their borrowers and making sure everything is running smoothly. So we think we have a good team of managers who have got the processes in place, have got the staff in place to monitor and manage this crisis. Their loan books. So. And besides that, the other thing Paul mentioned, several of these private debt funds that we're involved in, they've been doing this for an extended period of time. One of our mortgage lenders, for example, has been in the business since late 90s. So they've been through many, many cycles. Another one of our private debt managers has been in the business since the early 2000s. So they've been through a number of these different cycles. And so they have the staff in place and they have the processes in place to protect in these situations. And they have managed through many situations in the past, economic crisis, the 2007 and 9 and earlier this decade, and 15, I think it was a bad period for them. 2001, one of them anyway. So yeah, they have quite a lengthy experience.
Yeah, we hear from them during our calls is that during these crises, usually there's a lot of opportunity. They come out of it doing well because there's a lot more opportunities where the banks tighten their lending standards. And so that provides a large number of new companies into their pipeline, which to make some very attractive loans too.
Yeah, they're all quite excited about the opportunity set that they see coming forward. We saw it in 2008, 2009, banking regulations were changed as a result. Reserve requirements had to be set aside. The banks were not interested in doing short-term loans. And this whole private debt industry just grew in leaps and bounds. And so they're all quite excited about that and look forward to when things sort of calm down that they can get back to bringing, raising capital and taking advantage of these new opportunities they see out there.
Great. Okay, I think that's it for this week. We're out of time. Thanks for chatting.
Well, that sounds good.
Okay.
Thank you.
We'll talk to you next week.
All the best.